Most of you are probably familiar with the Newbery traditions. The secret choice, the phone call, the Today Show summons, and the frenzy which follows. I've lived overseas for 16 years and was not aware of these traditions. All I knew was that the Newbery Medal was the most honored of blessings. On February 6th, I was home alone in England and had been wrestling all morning with a manuscript. Feeling ornery and frustrated, I fled to our backyard to vent one of my muffled screams. Muffled because I am a headmaster's wife, and it isn't seemly for me to scream too loudly. In the midst of that scream, the phone rang. A ringing phone in a headmaster's house often signals a crisis, and when it rings, I'm well trained. I grab pencil and paper, ready to record the name of the student with appendicitis, or the name of the dormitory whose pipes have burst. That afternoon, I scribbled, American Library Association and Newbery M.E.D. The writing trailed off there. I still go weak when I think of that call coming so unexpectedly, jolting my world so intensely. My first reaction was disbelief, followed by overwhelming gratitude. I felt as if the eye of God had beamed down on me, and I'd better do everything I was told. In the days that followed, whenever the phone rang, and it rang constantly, constantly, I stared at it suspiciously, expecting that this caller would say, "Oops, sorry, we made a mistake. It wasn't your book." I had a lot of difficulty coming to grips with why I was receiving such good fortune and why my book was receiving such an honor. I'll be honest, I hadn't dreamed a dream this big. When I read articles referring to me as an unknown, I felt peculiar, as if I'd previously been invisible. But the articles were accurate. I was virtually unknown in the field of children's books in the States. An unknown has simple prayers. Please let my books be published. Please let readers know these books exist. Please let me keep writing. What the Newbery does is answer all of these prayers. It calls attention not only to my books, but to other new books as well. It celebrates children's literature. What a grand thing this Newbery is. Several days after the Newbery call, I returned to the manuscript I'd been working on that extraordinary day, and I reread this opening paragraph. "Life is like a bowl of spaghetti. That's what my grandmother used to say, and I'd imagine myself rummaging among twisted strands of pasta. But there was more to her saying. Life is like a bowl of spaghetti. Every now and then you get a meatball. I saw that meatball as a tremendous bonus you might unearth in all those convoluted spaghetti turns of your life. It was something to look forward to, a reward for all that slogging through your pasta." On February 6th, I received news of one glorious meatball in my plate of spaghetti, and no one on this earth could be more grateful than I am to receive it tonight. I'm grateful to many people for the birth of Walk Two Moons, and some of these include my husband, children, and larger family, who provided inspiration for many of the characters in this book, 5 editors, each of whom left his mark, as they came and went during the 3 years it took to polish Walk Two Moons, in England, Marion Lloyd, Lynette Wilson, and Isabel Barrett, and in the States, David Gale and Nancy Sisko. I would also like to thank Bill Morris, Virginia Anagnos, Alicia Mickles, Lisa Disseminy, George Nicholson, and everyone at HarperCollins who contributed to Walk Two Moons or who aided me these past months, and my agents, Carol Smith and Jonathan Dolger. My gratitude also extends to that wild and crazy highlights group at Chautauqua in 1988, who convinced me that writing for children was a most worthy and noble pursuit. As for the American Library Association and the Newbery Committee, I don't know if I'll ever be able to convey to you how much this award means to me. With one phone call from Philadelphia to London on February 6th, you dramatically altered my plate of spaghetti. And now to writing and the evolution of this book. I have to begin on a serious note because it was a serious jolt that led me to all these words. In 1980, when my children and I had been in England for 9 months, my father had a stroke. Although he lived for 6 more years, the stroke left him paralyzed and unable to speak. Think of all the words we wanted to say to him, and all the words he must have wanted to say to us. Think of all those words locked up for 6 years, because his mind could neither accept nor deliver words. A month after he died in 1986, I started my first novel, and when I finished it, I wrote another and another and another. The words rushed out. The connection between my father's death and my flood of writing might be that I had been confronted with the dark wall of mortality. We don't have endless time to follow our dreams. But it might also be that I felt obligated to use the words that my father could not. How does a book begin? Here I would like to tell you something that my mother related to me in a phone call last year. She'd awakened suddenly in the night to a voice commanding her to dash something to the floor. She grabbed the nearest thing at hand, the television's remote control, which she dutifully dashed to the floor. But no, that did not satisfy the voice. Next, she grabbed the lamp and dashed it to the floor. There, that was it. The voice was quiet. "Mom," I said, "did the lamp break?" "Yes," she said, "it did." She did not seem troubled by the broken lamp, nor did she wonder why it was a lamp that needed to be dashed to the floor in the first place. Instead, she seemed relieved that she had accommodated the voice. This is similar to how I begin a book, with a voice commanding me to dash something not to the floor, but onto paper, and I dutifully snatch any words or characters which appear. Only after the book is completed can I identify some of the seeds from which these seemingly arbitrary characters and situations come. But I am reluctant to dig too deeply, and to explain why I need to tell you about the talcum powder. I once owned a bottle of Chanel talcum powder, which I used daily. Oddly, the contents never seemed to diminish. Would the container never be empty? Did it refill and replenish itself? It was a mystery, which I enjoyed. But I also feared that someone would come along and explain exactly why it was that it never seemed to empty. Just as someone once explained, to my complete disappointment, that dreams are merely little chemicals sloshing around in your brain at night. The truth is, I don't want to know the explanations for the mysteries of dreams or of a replenishing bottle of talcum. Like Salamanca, who needs to believe a tree is singing, or that the spirit of someone she loves inhabits that tree, it is the mystery I need. And although I can and will tell you some of the sources for Walk Two Moons, I hope to leave some of it a mystery, even to myself. 4 years ago, after I'd already written two very different versions of this book, versions which did not include Salamanca or the Hiddles, I received this message in a fortune cookie at a Chinese restaurant in Surrey. "Don't judge a man until you've walked two moons in his moccasins." Beneath this saying was the note, "American Indian proverb." This seemed a curious thing to receive in a Chinese restaurant in England. At the time, I would have preferred a more traditional fortune, perhaps one like Patricia McLaughlin once received proclaiming, "Your talents will soon be recognized," or the one Lois Lowry received forecasting that she would become rich and famous in a far-out profession. Still, I was intrigued by the American Indian proverb, with its suggestion of a journey and the resonance of that single word, moccasins. My cousins maintain that one of our ancestors was an American Indian. As a child, I loved that notion, and often exaggerated it by telling people that I was a full-blooded Indian. I devoured Indian myths, and among my favorites were those involving reincarnation. How magnificent and mysterious to be Essa Natalie, the woman who never dies. She grows from baby to mother to old woman, and then turns into a baby again. And on she goes, living a thousand, thousand lives. I wanted to be that Navajo woman. I wanted to live a thousand, thousand lives. I crept through the woods near our house, reenacting these myths, and wishing, wishing for a pair of soft leather moccasins. I admit, but without apology, that my view of American Indians was a romantic one. I also climbed trees. I think I spent half my childhood up a tree, for I had somehow got it in my mind that Indians climbed trees. And there in those trees, oh, you could climb and climb, and you could reach a place where there was only you and the tree and the birds and the sky. It was a place where the sky was wide, and something in you, which was larger than you, was alive. And maybe the appeal of trees also lay in the sense that they live a thousand, thousand lives, appearing to die each autumn, and then, miraculously, be reborn in all their glory each spring. During the summer of my 12th birthday, my family took a car trip from Ohio to Lewiston, Idaho. What a journey! What a country! What spectacular and unexpected sights reared up around each bend. Midway through this journey, and because it was my birthday, I can tell you the exact date, July 29, 1957, we stopped at an Indian reservation, and there I was able to choose a precious gift, a pair of leather moccasins. On the final day of our outward-bound journey, we crested Lewiston Hill and stared down at the road which switchbacked all the long way down into Lewiston, nestled at the bottom alongside the Snake River. And all the way down that hill I prayed, for I feared that we would never make it to our destination alive. Those of you who have read Walk to Moons will recognize similarities between Salamanca's journey and my own. The significance of my journey in 1957 is that I remember it not only as a literal and physical journey across America, but also as a metaphorical journey. It was a time when I was enriched and inspired by our vast country and all the various people who populate it. There was a larger, lush, and complex world outside my own. The proverb in my fortune cookie revived that trip for me and restored the girl who wanted to be an Indian. I don't see Salamanca as a Native American. I see her as an American who, like me, has inherited several cultures and who tries to sort out who she is by embracing one strand of that heritage. Salamanca needs those stories of reincarnation. They give her hope. The portion of the proverb which became the title appealed to me on another level as well. In Walk to Moons, I saw an invitation from characters to writer and from writer to reader. Come along and walk with us a while. Slip into our moccasins so that you might see what we think and feel, and so that you might understand why we do what we do, and so that you might glimpse the larger world outside your own. You could live a thousand, thousand lives. Every book implicitly offers this invitation, and every book offers a journey, whether it is a literal one, a metaphorical one, or both. Mysteries appeared as I wrote, the singing tree, the marriage bed, the characters themselves. In the afternoons, when I reread what I'd written in the morning, I didn't have the vaguest idea how some of these things got on the page. It is nearly 3 years since Walk to Moons was completed, and now I look at it with a different eye. I can see that Salamanca is me and my daughter. I can see that Gramps and the good man father combine elements of all the good men in my family, and that Graham is what you might get if you took all the women in my family and rolled them into a ball. I'd better add that we might not seem as endearing as the characters in this book. If you spent some time with us, you'd see that sometimes we drive each other crazy, and we would probably drive you crazy too. As one of my brothers once said, referring to our annual family reunion at Chautauqua, it's a zoo, but it feels good in the heart. And I know where the singing tree came from. On our school campus, bordering the playing fields, is a magnificent bank of trees. Overhead, clouds drift across a wide expanse of sky. While I was riding Walk to Moons, I'd often escape to this place, where increasingly I felt that my father was inhabiting those clouds. It was comforting to think that he was always nearby, for there are always clouds in an English sky. One day I heard a magnificent bird song coming from the top of a tree, and it seemed that the tree itself was singing. Instantly, I had the further sense that my father had leaped from the clouds to the tree. A few years ago, when my youngest brother and I were sitting on the porch at Chautauqua Lake, I told him about this incident and asked him, "Do you ever have the feeling that Dad is in the clouds or in the trees?" My brother glanced at the clouds and the trees. He said, "Nope, can't say that I do." Ah, well, still, maybe the talcum powder, my father in the clouds, and the singing tree in Walk to Moons are related, for they all represent mysteries, and they all offer hopes of life never ending. I can also, I think, retrace the evolution of Graham's spontaneous eruptions of joy. Huzza, huzza. Though I do so with a bit of worry about the talcum powder, for I'd hate to empty all the mystery. But here's one speculation I can offer. In my study are dozens of pictures of my family, so that everywhere I look, someone is looking back at me. On the bulletin board nearest my desk are two quotes and two of my favorite pictures. These things have something in common. In one photo, my son is standing on an alpine peak, silhouetted against the sky. In a similar one, my daughter is reclining on a different mountain peak. There they are at the top of the world, like me and my trees, where the sky is wide and something in them is alive. You should see the expressions on my children's faces. Each has been caught in a moment of supreme joy. One quote tacked near these photos is from Ernie Pyle's Second World War correspondence. It reads simply, "The human spirit is just like a cork." I love that line. The human spirit is just like a cork. The second quote is from an autobiographical essay my mother wrote in 1933. She was 15 years old. It was the middle of the Depression. Her life was not an easy one. But she says in the middle of this essay, "Whenever I feel especially happy, I tap dance." And I love that line too. It is hard to picture my mother tap dancing, but I like to think that she has had many moments in her life when she felt so happy that she tap danced, when her spirits rose like a cork bobbing to the surface. Perhaps Graham's huzza huzzas in Walk Two Moons grew out of those pictures on my wall, the notion of a spirit rising like a cork, and the image of my mother tap dancing. When I was writing Walk Two Moons, the newspapers and the BBC were filled with images of war and disaster, of bombings, riots, floods, earthquakes, famine, torture. Every day my students stared into Pandora's box, filled with all the terrors of the world. Every day there was something difficult to face. Maybe I wrote this book because my students and I, like Salamanca, had stared those terrors in the eye as best we could, and then needed, for a time, to clutch the hope that was down in the bottom of Pandora's box, and with that hope turn to the other box, the one with the mysteries and smooth, beautiful folds inside. Salamanca and I need to face the terrors, but we also need mystery, and we need hope. When I read Salamanca's story now, with some distance, I hear such longing in her voice, for her mother, for her father, for the land, and I know that her longing is also my longing. I know this book was also written because I was living an ocean away, longing for my children, my larger family, and for my own country. I'm going to close soon before I empty all the talcum powder out of this book, but I'd like to give it just a few more brief shakes. Recently, I received another meatball in the mail. It wasn't a Newbery Medal sort of meatball. It was a packet of letters written by my father to my aunt during the Second World War. And they, too, are filled with longing for his wife, for his first child who was born while he was overseas, and for his country. The miracle of this gift. There is his voice. There are his words. The last line in each of his letters is identical. He says, "Write me often." 50 years later, maybe that's also part of what I'm doing, writing him often. The final letter in the stack was not written by him, it was from my mother, telling my aunt that she'd just heard from my father and that he was on his way home from the war. My mother wrote, "I'm so tickled and happy that I can hardly work. I jumped and squealed for joy last night." Do you hear that cork rising? Do you think she tap danced? People have asked me how I feel now, 4 months after the Newbery call. I still feel overwhelming gratitude. I still have bouts of disbelief, and I still fear that someone is going to come along and take this meatball away. Thank you for honoring this book and for making it possible for me to be in these moccasins tonight. If I could sprinkle some hopes over all of you, they would include these. I hope you each find a meatball in the spaghetti of your life. I hope your talcum powder never empties. that your spirit is like a cork, and that you all live 1,000,000 lives. And finally, at the end of the Newbury call, Kathleen Horning, the committee chairwoman, said, "We have one last thing we'd like to say to you." What she said is also the last thing I'd like to say tonight, and it is the last thing Salamanca Tree Hiddle says in Walk Two Moons. Huzzah, huzzah.